Afternoon and welcome to your own health and fitness talk show. I'm health integration specialist Lena Berman, and I'm here live with you Tuesdays at 2 talking to you about health care and fitness and taking your calls. Well, today is the first of two special pledge drive shows, so we won't be taking callers on the line for questions, but we will be taking callers during a brief musical break and then toward the end of the show to invite you to pledge and become a member of KPFA. If you do that today during this show, there are some thank you gifts that will go along with it. You know, I'm looking for 15 new subscribers and maybe 30 pledges during the hour. That's the sort of chore that I've been given for the hour, and I hope you'll cooperate with me. If people join at a $75 level, you'll get a copy of Dr. Joan Matthew Larson's book, 7 weeks to Sobriety, The Biochemical Connection. We'll be interviewing her briefly here, meaning that we will interview her in a brief moment, although not a brief interview. And if you join during the hour with a $75 pledge, you'll get a copy of this very groundbreaking book, this very important book, and you'll see as the interview unfolds. If you want to join for a $60 level for a thank you gift, we'll give you a copy of today's show. We'll give you a cassette of today's show. And if you want both the cassette and the book, that'll be $115. So just briefly to remind you, the numbers again to call us if you want to pledge during this hour and support this programming, it's 510-848-5732 or 1-800-439-5732. As I mentioned, I have on the line Dr. Joan Matthews Larson, and we will be talking about her groundbreaking treatment for alcoholism, food, and substance abuse. Her book, again, is called 7 Weeks to Sobriety, The Biochemical Connection. Briefly, before I get into the interview, I just wanted to make a quick mention of something which comes up in the book, which is the connection between depression and exercise. There was a friend of mine sent me, actually, an article from the New York Times reporting on a study where they said they weren't sure that there was a connection between having exercise be helpful for depression or to eliminate depression. Well, there's something very strange about this particular study they did. What they did was they followed a group of doctors and tracked those who exercised versus those who didn't. These were all rather type A personality people, those who exercised in an exhaustive, sort of intensive way. They didn't exercise gently or lightly, or these were people who worked out hard. And when they looked at them over a period of years, what they discovered was that in terms of sort of quality of life issues and whether or not they had depression, the groups who exercised versus the groups that didn't seemed to be about the same. Well, there's a flaw in this study. First of all, they've eliminated women again, which I guess happens quite a bit. But in addition to that, what's wrong with this study is that it has always been true that if you hurdle yourself at exercise, and if you train in a way that is not supportive to your health and your state of mind, it will be depressive. Too much of anything that's good for you can be turned on its ear and become something which does more damage than good. And we've seen this in all areas, including exercise. I've said many times on the show the benefits in terms of improving immunity and as we've mentioned, supporting you and preventing depression and maintaining health and burning fat and staying lean. All these things turn completely around if you do too much exercise or if you exercise in a way that's inappropriate for you. So all I wanted to say is that I think that we've even had callers call in and talk about the fact that if you exercise in a way that's appropriate for where you are, and that may just be going out and taking a walk, it does have a dramatic effect on the way that you'll feel. If nothing else, it will also give you a change of pace and a change to your state of mind. In addition to that, you'll have a better sense of feeling that you have something you can do that impacts on the way that your body performs and feels and looks. And that helps with depression. Let me give Joan Matthews Larson a brief introduction here. 20 years ago, after the tragic death of her husband, Dr. Larson had returned to school for an advanced degree in order to support her family and her children. while working on two psychology internships, her son Rob started on a path of addiction that would later lead to his death by suicide. Dr. Larson holds a doctorate in nutrition and is founder of Health Recovery Center in Minneapolis, where they successfully treat patients suffering from substance abuse using orthomolecular nutritional intervention. So I want to welcome Dr. Larson to the show. Are you there?
Yes, I am. Thank you.
Welcome to the show. Now, you're someone who believes rather strongly in the healing potential of skilled cognitive therapy.
Oh, I do.
Yes. So how did your son's experience change your understanding of how people become addicts?
Well, I had really no understanding of alcoholism at all in those days, but I did see a child who I, of course, knew so well go from being an active, bright kid that loved football. He loved to act and play. He was full of life. To someone that exchanged all of that for keggers, for parties, or beer parties, and it was, of course, after my husband had died, and I know that the sadness of it all affected Rob, but what finally really destroyed him was the alcohol. He quickly realized he could drink enormous amounts, and that is certainly a red flag for having inherited genetically the chemistry for alcoholism. And in his early teens, he began to be out late at night, to be drinking heavily. Everything changed for him. And the depression that I had never seen before began to show itself. And it took me, I'm ashamed to say, until he was 16 before I said, I will get you some help. You know, at that point, I couldn't miss what was happening to his life. He was simply all askew. And so I put him in a hospital setting for adolescents here, one that has a fine reputation. And I still did not know a lot about what was going to happen, but I figured they were the experts.
Well, you know, aside from the fact that in your own experience, in your family, the sort of treatment plans that have become popular, all of the ones that everyone knows about, including 12-step, mm-hmm. what you found was that in addition to quite a bit of very good therapy, didn't change a cascade of symptoms that seemed to be generated by a sort of a complex biological trigger, that there was something that was happening. And
The cravings and the depression that were really part of the his biochemical makeup didn't respond to words at all.
Okay, but I
found that it was, when I look back, a terrible time as far as his stability and his ability to look inward at his life and his faults and all of that, because he already was in a very fragile state from the depression and from the damage from the alcohol. And what started out as depression finally became despair at day after day reviewing the misery of his life and his faults. So that whole thing ended exactly as a nightmare. He came home really feeling hopeless, still craving alcohol, came into my room in the middle of the night and said how sorry he was that he had been so much trouble since his dad had died, and that everything would be all right from now on. And what I didn't understand was that I was going to find him a couple hours later dead out in the garage. He took his life. So that's what really made me start looking for whatever was missing. And at that time, I had no idea what I was looking for, but I knew treatment didn't do enough.
What I think is important about understanding this is, because I can still imagine some people saying, yeah, but, you know, he was depressed about his father and this and that, so there's a psychological reason here. But what you say in the book is that depression may lead people to some compulsive behaviors in the sense of trying to make themselves feel better, like maybe eating candy or drinking a lot of soda pop or eating junk food, that people are attracted to sort of eating patterns that may be may not be supportive to their health. But that what actually happens is that when a person who is predisposed to having potentially food allergies or some things that we'll talk about in a bit, when they begin to change their biochemistry by adding sugar to the diet and then alcohol.
Yes.
So why don't you describe this sort of cascade, how this sort of domino thing happens? Why don't you explain how that can happen?
Well, in some, there really is a predisposition biologically to be highly reactive to certain foods or chemicals, like alcohol. Alcohol is just one tree in the forest. And there are favorite foods that these types go back to all the time. And because they like the lift, just like alcoholics like the lift they get from alcohol, and don't seem to grasp that there's going to be a downside, and that downside is set off by, it will set off addictive cravings, it'll set off mood changes and an altered brain.
So how does this start?
You know, it...
I mean, the way you describe it in the book is you say that, as I just started to explain, somebody who may be depressed suddenly begins to eat comfort foods.
Sure, and there is, if you have alcoholic chemistry, believe me, the non-alcoholic does not grasp what we're missing, because we do not get that euphoric high and that energizing effect. We get sedated by alcohol. Alcohol relaxes us, and we pretty much have a fixed tolerance. We're not going anywhere with it because we simply can't handle much. But those things are not true of people who have inherited alcoholic chemistry.
So
they have the opposite effect. And I believe if we all had that response to alcohol, there would be a lot more people drinking, because it's something that can lift their spirits in a way that they can keep drinking for huge amounts.
Well, in your book, you describe at least three different types of genetic predisposed people who are either genetically predisposed or who through environmental exposure have had some immune changes that make them more sensitive to addiction to substances, foods, and alcohol. And what you said in your book is that there is a root to this, and you've described it in terms of the biochemistry of what happens. Why don't you describe the groups and how they're different,
right,
and how they're predisposed?
Well, the group that we see the most of are the allergic addicted. And those people, it isn't just alcohol. When we finally start testing, we do see a lot of food sensitivities as well. But these, not necessarily do they love alcohol from the first moment, because they usually get sick from it. Their first experience isn't glorious, but they continue to learn how to drink, and they love the highs. And the lows aren't that bad at first. And alcohol alters their brain to the point where they don't make choices anymore, and they really don't have an overview, which is different from another type of alcoholic. They are sensitive to forms of ethanol in their work. If they work, say, as a garage mechanic or a house painter, and they're breathing in low levels of ethanol all day, of alcohol, they will be going to the bar right after work, because they have a low sense of intoxication really going from breathing those fumes. So these people are particularly vulnerable to forms of ethanol.
Okay, so one of the things that you're saying is that there are people who are, whether it's genetic or whether we're talking about environmental damage, they're people who will tend to be very sensitive to chemicals and possibly foods.
Mm-hmm.
And when they're exposed to those things, like you said, for instance, I remember that printers,
yeah,
become alcoholics because they're breathing, they used to be breathing a lot of ethanol. So people who are exposed over a long period of time can become sensitized to these materials. Why do they become addicted to it then?
Well, it's because the initial response of the body is to pour endorphins to get comfortable. It knows it's being poisoned, and antigens that are put out finally to try to fight the invader, as the body interprets it, are the ones that do the damage and cause the changes. But the initial response is always delightful. And in fact, I can remember, and this has nothing to do with alcohol, but I am chemically sensitive to a number of things. And as a child, I used to love to get into my dad's garage before he would open the big door so that I could smell the rubber and the gasoline. And I just loved it. Well, now, many decades later, I cannot tolerate the smell at all. And most perfumes, unless they come from, you know, flowers at $500 an ounce, are made from ethanol, and I cannot wear perfume.
Okay.
So for many years, the initial response is delightful, and the low side isn't very noticeable. But that gradually tips, where you don't get much from it, and then you really get the negative side. And that's what happens to the alcoholic who is an allergic addicted drinker.
Very briefly, for those of you who are moving around through the dial, this is Your Own Health and Fitness on KPFA-FM. We're in the middle of a pledge drive, and I'm doing a special show. I'm interviewing Dr. Joan Matthews-Larson, Director of Health Recovery Center in Minneapolis, and we're talking about her book, 7 Weeks to Sobriety, The Biochemical Connection. We're talking about both alcoholism and other forms of substance abuse and the connection between those disorders and chemical sensitivities, food allergies, and other biochemical, other orthomolecular states, and the way to treat this. So what we're saying is that it's not just the allergic addictive. You've listed some other types of things.
Yes,
but
there are some totally different.
Yeah.
And these have always amazed me, and everybody's seen these people at parties. They can handle enormous amounts of alcohol, just super normally, and still appear sober. And they perform better on alcohol for many years. It just kind of fuels their career. They seldom or ever have hangovers for years and years. They're typically the type A person, the driven, compulsive, you know, type of person that loves the energy and the euphoria they get from alcohol. And they will not show up for any help because they don't want anything to mess with that until they are maybe in their late 40s or 50s. And at that point, the overwhelming amounts that they have drunk is damaging every organ and system in their body. But along with treatment for that type of alcoholic is to look at the histamine levels that they have, because histamine inside the brain fires all our neurotransmitters, and it gets too high with this type many times, and so it's way above normal, and their minds race, and they have a kind of an anxious depression. By lowering the histamine, by blocking it with methionine, which is not a drug, it's just an amino acid, they lose all of that raciness, and they can concentrate better, and they're not so impulsive either as to decide to start drinking again on the drop of a hat. So that's a type that we see a lot of.
One of the things that you talk about in the book is what is actually going on biochemically in the body with these different individuals, whether they're people who are alcohol addicted or food addicted or people who are addicted to substance abuse like drugs. Mm-hmm. That there, you talk about things like the receptor sites for dopamine, about liver enzymes. In other words, there's been enough research to indicate that, as I said before, whatever the initial cause, whether it's genetic or whether, frankly, we're dealing with some environmental pollutants that people have been exposed to that kicks over the immune system to a hyperactive state or not, these are people who are not absorbing nutrients correctly. And in addition to that, if they become addicted to the use of things like high carbohydrate diets and sugar to make themselves feel better, to comfort themselves, then there's this downward spiral of an adrenal burnout.
Yes.
And you talk about how...
And the level of hypoglycemia in alcoholics is phenomenal.
And I would think in food addicted
And with the hypoglycemia is the corresponding hypoadrenal corticism, or the exhausted adrenal.
Well, so one of the things you said that was interesting is that low blood sugar causes the adrenals to release adrenaline. So your blood sugar goes down, your body starts producing adrenaline. And so if you're eating a lot of caffeine and sugar and your nutrition is inadequate and your lifestyle, you're pushing yourself constantly, eventually the release of these of cortisone, which is a stress hormone, cortisol, will cause your adrenals to atrophy and become weak.
That's right. Adrenals are called upon for a role that really isn't in their job description unless there's a bear chasing you or something serious, and they're continually having to put out steroids so that that releases the stored sugar then from the liver. So that saves you when the blood sugar is dropping to the point where you're going to pass out.
One of the things I wonder about, though, is that I understand that when people are upset, that they move to comfort themselves. And sometimes the method of comforting is based on some ignorance of what's going on in their bodies. And it makes the situation worse. You get into this, like I said, this snowball and this domino effect in their bodies where it becomes addictive, where the very thing you're addicted to gives you a small amount of comfort, and then you end up with these bad feelings afterwards, and then you need to do it again. And this is true with food allergies and chemical allergies and all sorts of things. I still wonder if there isn't a self-love issue somewhere in here, because you're dealing with people who are, for one reason or another, moving toward some, albeit not effective, way to comfort themselves, getting trapped. And to unwind this trap, I mean, what you seem to be saying is that if you unwind the biochemistry, that the issue of self-love or them being willing to take on treatment or do something kind to themselves or stop burning themselves out is less important, or do you think it's a marriage?
Oh, it is a marriage, but just consider that because alcoholism is genetic, that alcoholics are raised by a parent, typically, that is also ill with the disease, and so doesn't give the love and so forth that the child hopes for, not because they don't want to, but because that's all they can do at the moment. And that seems to repeat itself from generation to generation because of alcohol changing the status of the brain and creating depression and unstable moods and parents that lose it and yell and so forth. So I can understand where the young alcoholic is looking for comfort, but there are also some big biochemical pieces that people until the last few decades have never understood about a lot of alcoholics. One is that a whole group, and that's the British Isles, the Irish, Welsh, Scotch, and the Scandinavian countries, and the American Indians, do suffer from depression often because they don't make enough prostaglandin E1, which is at the end of the omega-6 chain inside the brain. But when they drink, alcohol activates what little prostaglandin E1 they have in the brain. And for the first time, the depression is gone temporarily. And so they become very fond of this substance to that. And eventually, they're using it really to solve their depression. The other piece of that is that many of those same people are pyroluric. They are anxious from childhood. They've lived with a lot of inner tension. But when they drink, they feel normal. They feel sociable. They, you know, it returns them briefly to what they've always wanted to be. So to pull the alcohol for people like that, both of those categories, and say, now I'm going to give you good counseling and you'll be on your way, is foolishness, because then now they're getting the full brunt again of all of the depression and the anxiety, and they have nowhere to hide. So fixing chemistry is so important to go along with the rest of treatment, and yet 95% of treatment programs, according to Time magazine in this country, do nothing but a psychological program, a 12-step program.
Yeah, well, I hear what you're saying. What you're saying is if you don't correct the biochemical balance, the therapy where you're digging up a lot of old pain is they can't tolerate it because they don't have enough capacity at this point. They're just too...
Actually, I think that's what was wrong with Rob.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, it had been 4 years since his dad died, so yes, there was depression among us, but it wasn't like the overwhelming fresh depression, and yet his chemistry. The kid was living on Mountain Dew.
Yeah, and right.
He was so hypoglycemic.
Right.
Before he died, I did have the opportunity to get a test for him. And it was just the bottom fell out.
All right, well, you know what we're going to do is we're going to just take a very brief musical break. And I want to do this partially to give people an opportunity to get a copy of your book and to join KPFA. If people call during this hour, and during the, I'm just going to take a maybe 45-second break here with music, but during that time, what you could do is dial us at 510-848-5732 or 1-800-439-5732. And for a $75 pledge, you get a copy of this book, Dr. Joan Matthews-Larson's book called 7 Weeks to Sobriety, and it is about the biochemical connection between alcoholism, and she does mention chemical sensitivities and food addictions and various other types of substance abuse. And biochemistry includes all the material you need to know about improving and correcting the with nutrients and stuff. So give us a call during this brief break. This is health integration specialist Lena Berman, host of Your Own Health and Fitness. You can also, for a $60 pledge, get a tape of today's show, or you can get both for $115. So call us at 848-5732 or 1-800-439-5732 during this brief musical break. And when we come back, we'll talk about the specifics of the nutritional program. We'll be right back. This is health integration specialist Lena Berman, host of Your Own Health and Fitness. And I'm on KPFA here with you doing a special pledge drive show. Thank you to those of you who are calling during this brief musical break at 510-848-5732. A little dyslexia kicking in. 1-800-HEY-KPFA. To receive a copy of my guest Joan Matthews-Larson's book, 7 Weeks to Sobriety, The Biochemical Connection, or to get a copy of today's show. You get the book for $75, the tape for $60, or both for $115, and then you get to support this type of programming, as you always have in the past. So let me continue with my interview. We'll go another 15 minutes or so, and then we'll give people an opportunity to get this book again. Joan, you recommend, it's a very step-by-step, the book is very step-by-step.
I tried to lay it out for at-home treatment, which
yes.
I don't know that has ever been attempted before, but many have been successful using just the book
right.
and doing exactly what we say to do.
Right. But what happens in the book is that before you get into the specifics of what types of amino acids and nutritional support you need, you suggest a number of lab tests that you found helpful in uncovering some of the causes of a patient's addiction. So why don't you talk about some of the lab tests that you think are important?
Well, we always do a chemistry profile because we want to know what the liver looks like. And we always do a glucose tolerance test, and that's a 5-hour test. But it's been well worth doing, even though we know we're going to see hypoglycemia. Some of the tests are so dramatic that it sticks in their minds forever what goes on inside of them when they load refined sugars.
Let me just insert something here. A lot of people think that they have hypoglycemia but haven't been diagnosed, and they think that hypoglycemia is just someone who gets shaky when they don't eat. Hypoglycemia is a very specific ailment, and it is something that can be tested. Do you want to explain the difference between people just being lightheaded if they don't eat and real hypoglycemia?
Well, what's happening with hypoglycemia is that the brain is losing its fuel, its glucose, and those levels keep dropping. And
why does that happen?
Why? Because they are so sensitive to refined sugars that when they eat high carbohydrate and refined sugars, the body begins to pour insulin trying to handle the rise of sugar, and it inappropriately pours way, way too much, so that you just can't win. You never quite get to keep what you ate in the way of a candy bar or whatever you're trying to load in to get some sugar.
Mm-hmm.
The hypoglycemia finally has to be dealt with, or you're going to be walking around spacey or lightheaded, or there's so many different symptoms. Some people have more emotional symptoms than physical,
mm-hmm.
It all clears up once you stop plying yourself with refined carbohydrates.
And of course, one of the ironies here is that in 12-step programs, many people sort of attach themselves to the 12-step programs, which gives them emotional support, but they continue to drink caffeine in huge amounts.
Yeah.
You were describing these amazing amounts of caffeine and colas, and then sugar and cigarettes. And so what happens is that they continue to destroy the immune system. They continue to impact on the immune system and destroy the adrenals by overstimulating the central nervous system. And then that, you know, so where are you at then? You're still you're very ill.
It doesn't just stay the same. It gradually
gets worse. Right, and this is one of the things you were talking about when you're talking about a dry drunk, which is someone whose behavior is still like a drunk because their biochemistry is so askew. What other tests do you use?
Well, we do thyroid.
Yes, and I was curious.
Amazing how much hypothyroid we find, and not off of the standard test necessarily.
Well, one of the things that really interested me about you finding the low thyroid is that there were two things. One is this new thyroid test, which I'd not heard of.
The fluorescence. Antibodies.
Yeah, it's called. Oh, it does test for antibodies?
Yeah.
Aha.
Here's what's happening. People who have candida, and I think it must really be for some time that the immune system has been valiantly sending out candida antibodies. The immune system gets confused and begins to pour thyroid antibodies as well. So if you have a regular thyroid test, the thyroid production is fine, but you're losing your thyroid.
I know about the antibodies attacking your thyroid. I'm well acquainted with this. What was curious about this is that the normal way that I understood you tested for antibodies was to do two blood tests.
Yeah.
Checking for microchromosomal bodies. Is this the same test you're talking about? Is the FAMA the same, or is this a scan? So this can be done whether or not you're taking thyroid medication or not. You can still test for antibody levels.
Oh, yes, indeed.
Okay. And then in addition to that, you know, I do know about the candida theory. I'm not sure that candida is the only thing. There are many theories why the thyroid gets knocked out. There's, incidentally, an absolute epidemic of thyroid disease in this country. It's astonishing.
You know, and let me say that even so, the darn standard tests come back and they're not that far out of range.
Right, and everybody's got the symptoms. You know, they've all got the cold and they're this. The other thing that's interesting is the relationship between thyroid and estrogen. And estrogen increases when you drink. Alcohol increases your estrogen levels.
No, I didn't know that.
Yes, it does.
Period.
And yes, that's why men who are alcoholics sometimes get, like, breasts.
Uh-huh.
And the weight gain and all of that stuff. And estrogen shares a receptor site with thyroid. And if too much estrogen will knock your thyroid out. So you'll get hypothyroid from too much estrogen.
And everybody is taking some form of estrogen.
Whether they know it or not. I mean, there was an article in the paper that talked about estrogen in hairspray. And in pesticides and all that. Anyway, that's a whole other show. You also mentioned that estrogen raises copper levels and destroys zinc.
Yes.
All right, then you also have people check for chemical sensitivities.
Yes, we do. And foods.
And foods. Now, with the food stuff, you're using blood tests. Incidentally, I have to confess, I have been through the entire environmental ecology mill several years back. So I went through all of these tests. The chemical tests I found it was very hard to find antigens that, you know, where they test you until they find a neutralizing dose.
Mm-hmm.
My experience is that using antigens doesn't help that much over the long haul, that you still have to address the underlying immune weakness or hyperactivity, and that means that a lot of it is to reduce your exposure to chemicals.
Yeah, I agree.
And then with the food tests, the blood tests, I found with clients as well. They seem to test things that you're not always conscious that you're allergic to, but the things that you know really hit you over the head, like the corn and wheat and milk for a lot of people.
Yes.
Often
and the
don't show up.
Reactions are certainly interesting.
But they sometimes don't show up on the ELISA Act and some of the IgA, IgB
you
tests.
You know, years ago, because we've been doing this since 1980, when we started out, we fasted people for 4 days.
Oh, that's so
and
hard.
Then we tested
yeah.
foods. And
yeah.
believe me, that's when you see the reaction.
Yeah, but you can also do it by just having them go on a hunter-gatherer
yes.
diet.
We've
yeah.
done it a number of different ways since then. But it is true that the blood tests alone will not uncover all the allergies.
Why don't you talk a little bit about what kinds of nutrient therapy you're using, because we're going to run out of time here,
okay.
and I want to make sure you talk about some of the things that you discovered about some of the amino acids and stuff that you're
well,
using.
Well, the detox formula we have put together over the years, and it really will stop the craving. We use a lot of glutamine and tyrosine.
Tyrosine is very interesting. One thing I should mention also is that I have heard that there is some danger in using tyrosine for people with antibodies.
With antibodies?
Yeah. Have you found that it works okay with people with antibodies in their thyroid? It's not supposed to. I've heard from some endocrinologists.
Now that's interesting.
Yeah, it's supposed to aggravate it because it can boost the thyroid, tyrosine. And I think when there's antibodies and the thyroid is inflamed, which is what happens when you have antibodies, which is what you're suggesting testing
right.
for, that it can, anything that increases, anything that's endocrinologic in nature will increase the inflammation in the thyroid instead of quieting it down, which is what you try to do with
right.
thyroid medication, is quiet the thyroid down. But you also say that it tyrosine and cocaine connection,
yes.
using
well,
it for cocaine addiction.
That is essential for the cocaine addict to reload the norepinephrine.
Wow.
Because they have fired off the last of their norepinephrine.
Yeah.
Although I will say that we don't see many times the really fragile chemistry in cocaine users that we see in the allergic addicted alcoholic.
Yeah, I'm not surprised. Yeah, because the immune system is so hyperactivated by this time with the allergic stuff. You also use GABA, which I thought was, forgive me, I thought was addictive. I mean, there was
no.
a whole thing in the bodybuilding community using GABA, and people
really?
Got very addicted to it, yeah.
No, we don't.
You haven't had a problem with it.
I've never seen anyone get addicted to it. But there is a formula that puts together GABA, glycine, and taurine, all of which are soothing, calming elements in the brain. And I've got to tell you that it really... I've seen how it can change someone who is all a flutter to calming them down in a matter of a few, maybe 10 minutes or so.
One of the reasons that you use a good dose of some of these amino acids is as you've mentioned, the gut and the immune system is already damaged in allergic addictive people. And so sometimes they're not absorbing, even though you can put them on a diet that's lower in carbohydrates and cleaner and has more protein, they're still not absorbing very well. So that's when you've intervened with some of these amino acids and vitamins.
Right.
We're
using a lot of taurine now, too, and that
uh-huh.
will stop the shakes, which we see a lot of coming in.
Taurine is very good to boost the immune system in terms of illness, too. It's very good for that. The other thing that you're using, you mentioned tryptophan, and I'm wondering whether you actually have found a way some doctors can prescribe tryptophan, but it's off the market.
Well, our doctor prescribes it. However, I wish I would have dug that out for you. There is a manufacturer in the States for animals, and they, I don't know that they're a manufacturer, but they're a distributor, and they distribute for the very pure pharmaceutical grade. So if you have a gerbil that needs tryptophan.
I do. I'm sure I have gerbils that
mm-hmm.
need it, yes.
You can call
sleep.
Them and say,
I have a gerbil
they
that's
will
not
send
sleeping.
Out the powder, and it's a much more reasonable, and their name is Biochemicals. I can give you the number if you want.
Sure.
520-577-4935. But just remember, it's you're ordering it for your gerbil.
For gerbils.
Mm-hmm.
Gerbil. So again, the name of the company is?
Bioceuticals.
Bioceuticals. and it's 520-577-4935 for animal use, tryptophan for
right.
animal use. Now, people who pledge pledge during the show today and order today's show on tape will get this number, because we've just said it on the tape, so you will have it for posterity, for your gerbil. For tryptophan. The sleeping disorder stuff, is this adrenal burnout? Is this because of what happens with the hypoglycemia and the immune system hyperactive? What's going on with the sleep disorder?
There's many reasons. I think people who have food allergies they sleep very poorly. But tryptophan, of course, works, and so does the melatonin, and so does that combination of GABA, niacin or niacinamide, and inositol.
Now, your 800 number is on the back of the book, which people are going to order by pledging today.
Great. It's 800-24-SOBER.
Yeah, 1-800-24-SOBER, but you will also get all of the information on these different... With the book, you'll get the formulas, so if you want to buy some of these things, they're available in health food stores, or if you want to get specific stuff that they have only, it's in the book, and it's also on the back of the book, their number. One last thing I wanted to ask you is, you mentioned something about low histamine levels and people with allergies, and I was really flummoxed by this, because I thought that people with hyperactive immune systems were flooded with histamines.
No, many people are low histamine. And what I mean by that is, within the brain, the histamine that's available to fire the neurotransmitters is inadequate. Everything's slowed down.
Incidentally, drugs and disorders that can increase your blood glucose level, just to scare people a little bit, one of the main ones is marijuana.
Mm-hmm.
Adrenal steroids. Glucagon really shocked me, because glucagon is something that our body naturally produces when you eat protein. Nope. And carbohydrates together.
Mm-hmm.
So how can you have too much glucagon? Anyway.
Don't know.
You don't know, but anyway, it's one of the things. And growth hormone, for those people who are taking a little extra growth hormone to get a few extra muscles, that can push you into hypoglycemia. You know, we're just about out of time here. This is very groundbreaking work, and I'm very grateful to you for having done it. And I'm also grateful for you to be making yourself available today for this interview.
Oh, it's a pleasure.
My sense of what I can tell from reading your book is that you have actually had, it's working. I mean, you're actually treating people, and they are
That's the beauty of this. We've had 18 years of watching in the treatment center, watching what works and what doesn't work. So we can prove our theories or disprove them right here.
And then once people's biochemistry calms down, then they can work on some self-love and some therapy and stuff like that.
Yes.
Okay. Dr. Joan Matthew Larson, PhD, nutritionist, and you've done some work in psychology as well, from director of the Health Recovery Center. I want to thank you so much for your book, 7 Weeks to Sobriety, and for making some of these copies available to us at KPFA. I wish you a lot of continued luck in your work. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
This is Lena Berman. It's been your own health and fitness on KPFA, 94.1 FM. Talk to you.